Welcome to episode 132 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. Gary has been missing in action last time and this time because he was out cycling in France. And he is flying back. He's on a plane as we speak, which is really bad timing because what better time to be biking in France than when the Tour de France is going on? So the other thing I wanted to mention is that since our last episode, when we announced that the Journal of Family Practice has a new editor-in-chief, permanent replacement for our colleague, John Hickner, since that time, we have had the establishment of an endowment in honor of John at MSU. It will go to medical students interested in research and rural practice, and specifically to students on the Upper Peninsula. And we've put a link to the scholarship for those of our listeners who are interested in learning more about John, as well as for the scholarship. We've posted a link on our script.
Thank you, Henry. And we've been very happy to work with you and John's wife on establishing that. So on this podcast, we highlight poems or patient-oriented evidence that matters. You can get them all, one a day, from Essential Evidence Plus, plus a great primary care reference, over 800 chapters, thousands of interactive decision support tools, EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. That is now the 132nd time I've had to read that. So for a, and I'm not even going to read the IFP.com. I love them, but go to IFP.com and click on their online webpage, education webpage, if you want CME credit, and you can find our podcast and get half a credit for just listening to us talk about these three studies. We're going to be talking about new therapy for vasomotor symptoms of menopause, the diagnostic accuracy of the MCHAT for autism, and the value or lack thereof of steroids for community-acquired pneumonia. Kate, take it away.
Yeah, so today I am excited to tell you about a new medication option for vasomotor symptoms of menopause. This new drug, I've been practicing this, so I hope I get it right, fezolinetant, was recently approved by the FDA. It's being marketed as Veozah, which is just this close to a portmanteau that I guess I put this in the script for my own amusement and then I forgot to take it out. I guess I'll skip this part, not knowing whether Aww. It's... Yeah, you can go to the script and read it. I forgot to delete that before we started recording. Anyway, fezolinetant is a selective receptor antagonist that binds to the thermoregulatory center of the hypothalamus. It's supposed to block the stimulation that triggers the vasomotor symptoms in the absence of estrogen, which is also inhibitory. That's how a vasomotor symptom of menopause is supposed to happen. So this study was a phase 3 clinical trial. In terms of the conflict of interest, not only was the study sponsored, designed, and executed by Astellas, the company that developed the drug, the paper was also written by its employees, so it essentially checks every single potential conflict of interest box. The investigators conducted, it was an RCT, it's a 3-arm double-blind placebo-controlled trial, about 522 patients. So there are two drug doses, 30 milligrams and 45 milligrams, and then a placebo, each taken once a day. Participants were patients in menopause, ages 40 to 65, so a wide range, with an average of at least 7 moderate to severe hot flashes a day. That's slightly higher than the average 4 to 5 per day experienced by most people in menopause. The main study period was 12 weeks. And after that, those who were originally randomized to the placebo were re-randomized to one of the two active groups, while those who were on those medication dosages were continued on that current dose for an additional 40 weeks. Primary outcome was the mean frequency of hot flashes compared with placebo at 4 and 12 weeks. The outcome was significantly reduced in both fezolinetant groups. The 30 milligram had a baseline hot flash of 10.7 per 24 hours, reducing to 5.4 at 4 weeks and 4.5 at 12 weeks, compared to a baseline of 10.4 4-week of 5.2 and 12-week of 4.1 in the 45 milligram dose. And for the placebo group, it was 10.5 at baseline, 7.3, and 6.9. So again, somewhat improved. It's actually much better in the placebo group. So yet another thing that placebos do work for, just not as well as the active med. Results for symptom severity and symptoms were similar. Improvements were maintained over the 40-week extension period. Adverse effects they reported as minor, although the study was not powered to detect those sort of rare serious adverse effects. I went to the study company, the drug company website, and read through what do they recommend. They do suggest regular liver function monitoring while you're taking this medication. So what they're marketing this as is a non-hormonal. It is aggressively being marketed as a non-hormonal because, of course, our main treatments for hot flashes right now are mostly hormones. They work better than anything else we have. They do, of course, it's hard to compare exactly how well does this work compared to our other non-hormonal treatments, so SSRIs, SNRIs, clonidine, things like that, because none of those work very well. It is interesting to note that Paxil is actually the only other non-hormonal therapy that's currently FDA approved, although we do use a fair number of other things offline. GoodRx puts a cost of $500 to $600 a month for what it's worth. And of course, this is just one of those things, one small trial so far. This is just a phase three study, but look for this one to be hitting the OB-GYN clinicians near you. Henry, opinions about this?
So a tourist is riding in a hot air balloon, and the air balloon loses its heat and lands in the middle of a field. And the tourist happens to see a farmer and asks the farmer, "Where am I?" The farmer responds, "You're in the gondola of a hot air balloon in the middle of a field." And the tourist says, "Oh, that's really fascinating. You must be a designer of clinical trials for drug companies." And the guy said, "Wow, how did you know?" He said, "Well, your answer was accurate and precise and absolutely useless." The drug company studies, while all of the conflicts of interest we concern about, the internal validity, the truth within the study is generally quite good. The applicability to studying the patients that we care for, comparing it against interventions that we are familiar with, all of those other things are generally absent. So that gives us a chance to think about what are our other options. Well, we've got soy, which has a very checkered history. There's the hormone replacement therapy, either combined estrogen or systemic estrogen. You've got topical progestins, calcium channel blockers, and the SSRIs and SNRIs. So we have a range of other options that are out there of very mixed quality and mixed data. So the big question is whether any of that those other things are at least as effective as this new stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm a little more positive than Henry, perhaps. I would add gabapentin to the list of things that people try and that generally don't work super well. I mean, I thought for women who have, you know, significantly high number of hot flushes. Remember, this was a population that had about twice as many on average as is average for women with hot flashes. It reduced them. You know, instead of the placebo to 7, it reduced them to 4. So that's a pretty substantial reduction, I think. And for those women who have a lot of hot flashes and who don't want to take estrogen, you know, I think it's good to have an option. I do think that it would be nice to see a larger, longer trial in terms of safety. That would be one thing I'd look for. And, I do think sort of a limited duration period for a year, 2 years or so of the lowest effective dose of hormone replacement therapy should definitely be an option. I would absolutely not rule that out. Although I've had patients who've been very resistant to that because of all the concerns that they've heard about hormone replacement and cancer and, you know, things we've all talked about. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's definitely coming back into sort of the more mm-hmm. mainstream of care, particularly for people who are right in that immediate perimenopausal area, and obviously not as we get older, but right in that. Henry, I was very afraid for a second that was going to become an extremely tasteless joke about hot flashes, and I'm glad that it went a totally different direction. So
I was a bit on edge as well, but I thought that's a very
bullet
funny.
Dodged.
Well done. Okay, so we have another option. and one that has been studied. And I've had patients where we've tried SSRIs, we've tried gabapentin. I haven't tried calcium channel blockers, and finally ended up landing back on estrogen, which worked great. And the patient took it, this last patient I'm thinking of, for about 2 years, and then tapered off it and did well. So the American Cancer Society, here's the quiz. The American Cancer Society recommends that screening for cervical cancer begin at what age? 18 years, 21, 25, or 30? Stay tuned. Henry, let's talk about the MCHAT.
Thank you. This is of interest to me because both on my wife's side of the family and on mine, we have family members, close family members who are on the autism spectrum. So the MCHAT is one of those tools that has been widely used to screen for autism. So the question of this poem asks, how accurate is the modified checklist for autism in toddlers, the MCHAT, for identifying autism in children up to 4 years of age? And this was published by Wieckowski and colleagues in the April issue of JAMA Pediatrics. It's a meta-analysis, and they looked at three different databases to try to identify studies that use the MCHAT or the MCHAT revised with follow-up. To screen for children up to 4 years of age. And they didn't really look for unpublished studies. They and also did not address the potential for publication bias. They said that their interest was primarily in evaluating the modified MCHAT with the revised with follow-up. But when they actually looked at all of their data, they pulled any variety of the MCHAT. When they pooled all of those studies, they identified maybe 51 separate analyses without any real information about how many children were actually included in all of those studies. There were like 32 different variations of the MCHAT that they used, both in terms of different languages and modifications. Overall, the sensitivity was about 83% and the specificity 94%, which sounds pretty good, but the quality of the studies were really largely mediocre, which tends to really inflate those estimates. So, this was kind of a bottom line, kind of a crazy meta-analysis in which they kind of intended one thing and did something completely different. And based on these data, as poor as they are, it looks like there may be some reasonable accuracy. But the big second part to this is not just the fact that the quality of the studies were poor and the data were quite heterogeneous, is that we still don't have any data that shows that screening is better than establishing a diagnosis when there's a level of suspicion. Mark.
Yeah. So when I was on the USPSTF, I was one of the leads on the autism recommendation statement. And interestingly, we got, there was a lot of work done to protect us during the breast cancer update. And they told our local police at UGA, if there are any suspicious packages, going to Dr. Abel to not deliver them, to throw them in the bin or something. And as it turned out, the worst and most sort of vituperative, if that's a word, feedback was for this autism recommendation, which was an I recommendation. And an I is often misunderstood as a don't do something. And I think in this case, the I was because, as Henry said, there simply is no evidence. The MCHAT was, to me, the best tool because it was practical for a clinical setting. There was a short part, a short introductory part that you could do in a clinic. And then if it was abnormal, then you had a more intensive follow-up. And so that made sense to us. So we said, if you're going to do this, use the MCHAT. And, the review from the task force was that it was, reasonably accurate, I think, as we see here with the sensitivity and specificity. But the problem is all of the studies that were done of interventions for kids with autism were in kids who were mostly highly symptomatic. And what we're talking about is screening apparently asymptomatic kids. And we have no data at all that, there's any benefit to slightly earlier detection in a kid who's really has not been recognized. And I think you could make an argument that if you're in a setting, either a school setting or a setting, you know, in your community where you're not sure the parents and the teachers would be able to identify kids, then it might make sense to implement this. On the other hand, if you're school system is really up on this and the parents are, you know, highly motivated to find, you know, to know if they can identify kids with abnormalities, then it might be probably less useful. So this is a study that should be done. We actually called on Congress to fund a study like this. You could imagine in, if not in the U.S., and, you know, most family physicians don't do this. About a third to a half of pediatricians do this screening as part of their practice. So you could easily imagine a study where you were able to implement it in a randomized format or a stepped wedge design or something like that and get this answer. Because I do think it's an important question. Unfortunately, we just don't have data on it. Okay.
Yeah, you said most of the good things right there.
Sorry.
No, it's also, you know, we when we screen, it's little kids too. It's 18 and 24 month olds. So these are kids who haven't, you know, they, like you said, kids who have, you know, pretty substantial symptoms. Mostly their parents are starting to worry about them a little bit, and they'll mention it. And so it's, you know, not screening asymptomatic kids. It's screening kids who are not screening. It's trying to diagnose kids who have sort of come to light. And most parents are aware enough that when you're sort of taking those history questions about how's your kid doing, you know, are they using words? Are they, you know, using nonverbal methods of communication, things like that? It does sort of come up. And so I do think it's, you know, this meta-analysis went up to kids at 48 months, but yeah, we're doing 18 and 24. And so that may make a difference also. And I think the other issue is if you do that intensive intervention, that some of that data is starting to come under question too, that is that, you know, that sort of behavioral, intensive behavioral intervention, is that as effective in kids who have some of the more mild, functional impairments?
Yeah, there were, if I remember correctly, there were 6 randomized trials. They were all small. They were all poorly controlled. And they were all in kids who were highly symptomatic. And so that's just not applicable to a screening detected population of asymptomatic kids that are mostly younger as well.
And this is an age group, if remembers, that there's huge variability in what is normal. When you were thinking about 18 and 24 months of age. And so tools like this may help us with trying to track those who are outliers and maybe arrange for closer follow-up or maybe determining in greater detail. Oh, we've seen this in male members of the family with regards to delayed speech and things of that nature, delayed language development. But the problem still is that if we do identify a child who is truly autistic, what do we do? What do we know to be effective?
All right. So if you're going to screen for autism, use the MCHAT. I think that's at least my bottom line from that.
Yeah.
So the last poem today is the question was, for patients with severe community-acquired pneumonia, does hydrocortisone improve outcomes? This was in the New England Journal, 2023. And it's by Daquin and colleagues, and it's a French study, actually. And this was a federally funded study in France. Previous randomized trials of systemic steroids for patients with community-acquired pneumonia have found reductions pretty consistently in length of stay, but most didn't find a reduction in or an improvement in mortality. They've also been, you know, criticized these studies for flaws in study design, including a failure to mask or conceal allocation. And the IDSA guideline currently does not recommend or actually recommends against using steroids in patients with community-acquired pneumonia. And so, you know, this is an ongoing question. And I think this big study, well-done study, really helps us get at a good part of the answer. So this in this study, that they found 795 adults at 31 French ICUs who were in the ICU for severe community-acquired pneumonia. So that meant they needed a mechanical ventilator or high-flow oxygenation, or they had a pneumonia severity index in the highest category, 5 out of 5. Patients with sepsis were excluded. Everyone got standard therapy for community-acquired pneumonia, and then they were randomized to either IV hydrocortisone, 200 milligrams, for 4 days or 7 days, depending on the team's medical judgment, followed by a taper So they ended up getting a total of 8 to 14 days of steroids. The median time from ICU admission to getting that first steroid infusion was about 15 hours. At baseline, the groups were similar. The median age was 67 years. Just over two-thirds were men, and about a quarter had some comorbid chronic lung disease. Analysis was by intention to treat. All-cause mortality was slightly lower in the hydrocortisone group at 28 days, actually more than slightly, I'd say 6.1% versus 11.9%. So the number needed to treat is 17 to prevent one death of any kind. At 90 days, the NNT was still 18. So these were statistically and clinically significant benefits. In the group of patients who didn't need mechanical ventilation at enrollment, fewer patients in the steroid group later went on to require it, 18 versus about 30%. So the number needed to treat of 9 there. So there's no significant difference in hospital-acquired infections, which you might be concerned about. Patients using insulin did need about 15 extra units per day on average if they were in the steroid group. So this study found a clear mortality benefit for IV hydrocortisone in patients with severe community-acquired pneumonia. They didn't see any worrisome problems like an increase in other infections. There was another poem in the same month that I also wrote up from the journal Clinical Infectious Diseases, I think, that was a systematic review, and they found a reduction in the need for ICU admission or mechanical ventilation, but no impact on mortality. Most of those studies, though, were of patients without severe pneumonia. So the primary role seems to be for those patients with severe pneumonia, possibly, you know, less severe pneumonia, but you wouldn't expect to see a mortality benefit, but you might see shorter length of stay. So anyway, Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a narrow population. So people with severe, admitted for severe pneumonia without sepsis. So that's the first thing I'll note. A couple of years ago in one of our live courses, I presented a very similar study. People who got, I think it was a single dose or a short course of IV steroids when they were admitted for their severe pneumonia that found sort of similar outcomes. So it was reduction in length of stay and improvement in the sort of clinical composite score. The one thing that I remember specifically was a downside of that study is that it was also done, I want to say it was done in France, but it was done somewhere where their length of stay, average length of stay was about 6 days. So substantially longer than I think somebody would necessarily stay in the US. The other thing that I would take away from that I still remember from that study, it's been like 3 years, is that they used the expression taking food by mouth, which I just thought was the most like quintessentially doctor way of saying eating. We just can't say anything normally.
We can't just say eating. People wouldn't know we were doctors. Come on.
This patient taking food by mouth. Yes, they're eating. But yeah, again, similar findings. And I can't remember what the concerns were that led to the IDSA and other organizations saying not quite ready for prime time. But I wonder if, you know, this study and that one and others potentially in a meta-analysis situation might lead to that recommendation.
I would hope so. That guideline came out in 2019, so it probably won't be updated for another few years. But I know that some of the people that wrote that guideline, and I've had a bit of a debate, kind of email debate for what it's worth, and one time in person. It's just about this because I think there's pretty clear benefit, and they're like, no. And so I respect their opinion, but I think the data are getting more consistently in line with steroids, especially for those severely ill patients. Okay, so it is. Henry. Sorry, we need to get Henry a platform. Sorry.
Yeah. So here we have a fairly inexpensive and, in theory, widely available medication. It can't possibly work, right? Well, it turns out that it does. This is one of those areas where it does show some high levels of effectiveness. The harm side, though, I'm going to just sort of raise some caution. This is a relatively short duration study, relatively small. And so if there are unusual things that show up later, like GI bleeding and aseptic necrosis of the hip and things of that nature, it will probably take some additional kinds of studies to be able to determine that. But at least in the short term, the trade-offs of mortality and all of the other bad things that we talked about, this really looks pretty good. And my question to you, Mark, is this time to actually do a systematic review of steroids in those severely ill patients?
So first of all, I'll say to get aseptic necrosis of the hip, you have to be alive. So I think that's one thing. And it was over 700 patients, almost 800 patients, and it was a 90 days of follow-up, which is, I thought that's pretty good for a pneumonia trial. You know, that's most of them I've been reviewing this literature are 28 days and 28 to 30 days. So 90 days, I thought that's pretty good. They're going to catch most problems that happen within that time frame. And when you look at short courses of steroids and the harms that occur, typically it's within the next month or so that you see the biggest bump in that. Now, yeah, I think this would be a great opportunity for the investigators who did these trials. And if I remember correctly, a lot of the earlier trials were done by one group of people, I think in Egypt. I think it was in Egypt. And so it would be an opportunity to get those trialists together and to share their data and do an individual patient level meta-analysis where you can stratify by severity. Most of these studies did, you know, report severity. So you could look at the severe, the moderate, the milder pneumonia and analyze those separately. I think that would be really useful. So that's my answer. That good enough, Henry? Okay. Got the thumbs up. So the quiz question was, American Cancer Society recommends that screening for cervical cancer begin at what age? 18, 21, 25, or 30? So the most recent update to the American Cancer Society guidelines from 2020 recommend that women with a cervix initiate screening for cervical cancer at age 25 years. That's a bit later. You know, when that came out, I was a bit surprised, but they also recommend HPV as the preferred screening test, HPV testing alone, at an interval of every 5 years. They said co-testing every 5 years where you do cytology and HPV or cytology alone every 3 years are second line options. Screening can stop at age 65 if women haven't had CIN2 or worse in the past 25 years and have had normal tests in the past 10 years. This recommendation is a little bit different than the USPSTF, which recommends cytology every 3 years from 21 to 29, and then from age 30 to 65, either HPV alone, co-testing, or cytology. The USPSTF recommendation is from 2018. I checked yesterday. There is an update that's in progress, so expected, you know, probably later this year, perhaps early 2024. Hopefully, it will harmonize with the ACS. That always makes it a lot easier for clinicians and patients when they're hearing the same, the choir is all on the same page, singing the same hymn. And if you look at European countries, a number of countries have already started pushing the initial age of screening to age 25. So, you know, US certainly would not be alone in doing that. And this prevents some of the overdiagnosis and overtreatment and attendant complications of beginning screening earlier. I remember when I was, you know, first trained back in the early 30s, we were doing pap smear. Well, okay, they weren't doing pap smears in the early 30s. Papanicolaou, when did he invent it? Like 1940s, I think. And anyway, so we were doing, but you know, it would be the, you know, sometime in the late teens, we would usually begin doing pap smears. And so it's good to see the evidence. We understand the cancer better. We understand the causes. We understand the potential harms. And I think the guidelines are following that science. So, okay, well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening. Again, if you want CME credit, IAFP.com, click on their online IFP education webpage, and they're accredited to give you one half AMA category one credit. Hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends about our podcast, rate us on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get us, and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.